Bidder's Office, Chris Morehouse is here as well. I'll be doing the argument.
Mr. Garrity, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please. Right.
As you've heard, I will do my best, but it's on you.
Yes, sir.
Begin when ready.
Please, the court, again, Kevin Garrity from the Public Defender's Office. We're here today.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, sir.
Assuming your client was in custody, okay, what incriminating statements did he make?
We will concede today that given the fact that the Attorney General of the Commonwealth is right, that no incriminating statements were made outside of the identity fraud or identity theft charge that was dismissed by the trial court.
Tell me your concession again, please.
There are no incriminating statements that were made by Mr. Henley that deal with anything outside of the misdemeanor identity theft charge that was dismissed at the trial by the trial court on motion.
Well, given that concession, what are we left with?
We're left with the second issue in the.
I gather you are abandoning it.
I'm choosing not to argue.
Abandoning your first assignment there.
It's not what was going to be the focus of our argument today. We were going to focus on the second.
Well, I thought you used the word conceding.
Conceding.
I thought you said we concede that no incriminating statements were made. Is that correct?
Outside of an issue unrelated to what's on appeal here, the conviction on appeal. So, yes, sir.
All right, sir.
Well, then let's hear about assignment of error number two.
Yes, sir. So assignment of error number two, the court's familiar with the facts, but you have a young man on a sunny, warm day, and there's a call placed to the sheriff's office about him lying on the grass on private property in this condo complex. Three deputies arrive. Two of them are in tactical gear, all are armed and in uniform. They arrive in unison. Two have canine units in the car. The time they locate the appellant, he is seated with his back up against his residence in the condo facility there, and they approach him and ask for his name and information, which he is reluctant to give. He asks why he needs to give it. He's not giving a satisfactory response. Eventually, after refusing to give his name and other identifying information, he's given a pad and a piece of paper, or a pad and a pen. Eventually, writes something down, makes no representation as to what it is, and then goes to go inside the apartment. After entering into that private residence, the hallway that leads to the condos, an officer quickly has to move before the door locks behind him, detains him at that point, and brings him outside.
From a pure probable cause to arrest standpoint, are the series of numbers he wrote down on the piece of paper, could a reasonable officer conclude that he was giving a Social Security number, and then after they run it, that he gave a number that wasn't his. May not be right, may not be enough to sustain the conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, it wasn't. But could the officer believe he had been given a... Could a reasonable officer believe he had probable cause to believe that he had been intentionally given a false Social Security number?
I think a reasonable officer could have believed that the number was a Social Security number, not necessarily false. That is to say, he asked for the Social Security number, and a digit with that many numbers was put on that paper. Now, the deputy testified that took that information that the end part of that, those series of numbers, was illegible. So rather than try to clarify that with the appellant before he entered the building, he just radioed in two different numbers to dispatch, guessing what that last number or last two numbers were. That's where the deputy erred. He could have tried to clarify that, but instead he did some guesswork. There was no indication to a deputy, nor do I think a reasonable deputy could have believed, that there was any deception at that point. It was just he was having a hard time reading what had been written down.
And I don't recall from the record, was the actual social ever introduced?
No, I don't believe so, sir.
So we don't know if it was close or not.
I would have to take a closer look at the record, but I don't believe it was introduced, and I don't believe that we know that.
Let me ask you a question, if I may, about your second assignment of error. You allege that the jury erred because it did not find that the court erred in affirming the jury verdict when the not finding that appellant used a reasonable amount of force to resist an illegal arrest.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
That's not, however, what was argued. The motion to strike was that there was no intentional battery committed.
In terms of preserving the record for appeal, the law, while somewhat silent on affirmative defenses, is clear. And I will concede that even if the jury is a trier of fact, at least on other issues, the matter needs to be addressed to the trial court.
The motion to strike.
Objection.
Right.
While we did address the sufficiency of the evidence in sort of a general sense, or I should say I did, the affirmative defense was not specifically addressed. And I don't think it necessarily had to be at the first motion to strike. Certainly at the second motion to strike, or when we renewed that, it would have been better had I specifically addressed that. I do think that this can be distinguished in a couple of different ways from other areas. First of all, an affirmative defense is asking the court, not as the trier of fact, but the court presiding over a jury, to rule as a matter of law that our burden of proof has been met. It's different than asking the trial court to say, as a matter of law, this element has not been proven. It's different, and it puts the trial court in a position of usurping the rule of the trier of fact. The law is clear that when an affirmative defense is presented, it is for the trier of fact, that being the jury. Other justifications for the contemporaries' objection rule would be that to prevent unnecessary appeals. I think that's more applicable to if the statement's made, I would need to timely object to that from a witness. If I don't, then I don't give the trial court a chance to rule on it before I might just address it on appeal. Another issue is that the opposing side have a chance to respond to the objection at the time it's there, and that this court have a full record of not just the trial court's ruling on it, but just the argument by both sides as to the issue. But here, this court is presented with a full record. It was argued extensively by both sides. That is to say, the Commonwealth had a chance to respond, not only in closing argument, but frankly, in the jury instruction phase, when there was some back and forth about whether or not that instruction should be entered at all. So I think because it was an affirmative defense, not that we were trying to say that the Commonwealth hadn't met a burden of proof as a matter of law, and because the Commonwealth had a chance to respond, and there's a complete record, I would ask the court to consider it.
Well, are you asking this court to rule on an error by the trial court as to a potential defense that was not raised?
My position is the defense was raised, and it was raised to the trier of fact.
Tell me where in the you asked the court to rule on that question in the transcript.
Not the court, the trier of fact, the jury, is what I'm saying. It was raised there. I should have been more specific when I renewed the motion to strike, when that evidence had been introduced. I still think that this is distinguishable, again, from other instances where the court has looked at when an issue has not been preserved for appeal. Again, because it's an affirmative defense.
And the Commonwealth makes a great deal of, even if we accept the motion to strike part of this, that would be trial court error as a matter of law of this defense. But your assignment of error act is actually tied to the jury, and you didn't move to set aside the verdict as inconsistent with the evidence.
Moving to set aside again would have been smart on my client's, on my behalf, or on my part, no different than being more specific in renewing the motion to strike. The same reasons apply there. I think this court, I don't think either side is prejudiced, nor is this court lacking any information. Whether the trial court, and I understand what the case law says, but the trial court not having ruled specifically on that, but the fact that the jury did not accept it shouldn't prevent this court from reviewing that issue. As
but don't you have to offer the trial court an opportunity to rule on it?
I think the case law, at least towards an affirmative defense, the case law is clear that, yes, the trial court has to have a chance to rule on it. Now, I'm saying this is a slightly different situation as an affirmative defense, and furthermore, that because the Commonwealth was able to respond, because there's a lengthy record with argument to the issue, that there should be, that perhaps that needs to be reconsidered in this present case. Going back to the actual issue, putting aside whether it was preserved or not for appeal, the argument that the arrest was illegal and the jury was offered that instruction, what you had here again, though, is three different deputies that showed up simultaneously. I've described how they presented themselves. And then you had my client who was detained, and unrightfully so in our opinion, brought back outside. A breath test was administered. He was placed under arrest after he tried to go into his private residence. We believe that the arrest was illegal based on the fact that the breath test and anything else that came out of that illegal detention resulted in an illegal arrest. When the officers were asked, or at least Deputy Brubaker, Corporal Brubaker was asked, well, what were you investigating? He couldn't really come up with an answer. He said, well, we were not clear on his identification. We wanted to see if he had any warrants. Well, that's not a criminal investigation. They didn't have probable cause or even reasonable articulable suspicion at that point to detain him. So when the arrest was made...
Did they have probable cause to believe he was drunk in public?
Based on their observations and the preliminary breath tests that were administered, arguably, yes. Again, I think that the bulk of that information came after the illegal detention.
Well, let's stop it at the point of detention, given what was called in over dispatch by the EMS provider, all of the information that they were provided, given their interaction with him, his attempt or inability to write his Social Security number down on a piece of paper, their interactions with him, did they have reason? Could a reasonable officer have thought that he was drunk in public?
Before the preliminary breath test was administered,
yes.
I would argue no. And I think that despite some of the descriptions that the deputies gave in their testimony, their initial interaction with him showed no desire to investigate whether or not he was under the influence. They wanted his personal information.
Is the standard objective or subjective?
Objective.
Okay. So the questions are, could a reasonable officer, not one of these three necessarily, but a reasonable officer believe he either had committed identity fraud when he gave him the Social Security number, or did they have enough reason to believe that he had committed the offense of being drunk in public?
I think regarding the identity theft charge and the Social Security, again, that's no. He was clearly unwilling to give them anything to begin with and made no representations on what he wrote down as to what that information was.
Well,
and then they did not try to clarify because it was somewhat illegible.
Well, right, but from circumstances, I think you've conceded that it was reasonable for the officer to conclude he was giving him his Social Security number.
Yes, I think it's more reasonable for an officer in that position, based on his question or his request to say that. But the illegibility of the numbers, it's not like he had 10 clear numbers, radioed that in, and that came back not found. He wasn't quite sure what those last one or two digits were. The drunk in public is a little bit more difficult from the appellant's perspective in that argument. However, again, that preliminary breath test came afterwards. And the officers they didn't ask him, had he been drinking, was he under the influence or anything else. The appellant made no indication that he needed medical assistance. He was on private property, not a public road or a checkpoint or an airport.
Well, but... in public means amenable to public view.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm not arguing that in terms of the statute, the drunk
well,
public
okay,
statute.
Okay, but I mean, you said he's on private property, so what?
Well, I think that's part of the argument in terms of three deputies approach him to get his personal information, which is what started this off, and the circumstances that was on. He was on his own property outside on a nice day. Did he require any medical?
We've drug you deep into it. You're in your rebuttal time. You may want to save some.
I will reserve the rest. Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Bourne.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I think one issue that nobody has raised, but I think is an important issue, is that there was a Fourth Amendment issue raised in a motion to suppress in this case, and the court found that there was a probable cause to arrest him, and he didn't challenge that on appeal. So at this point, that's gone. He didn't challenge the Fourth Amendment. He only challenged the Fifth Amendment claim on appeal. So, and that sort of points to the larger problem with this entire case and this argument about it being up to the fact finder to make these decisions and that we don't have to preserve this argument by raising it to the trial court. And that is, the trial court had already determined that there was probable cause. And that is a legal issue, not a factual issue. It's a mixed question that has to be raised before the trial court. So the trial court had already reached that in its response to the motion to suppress. And then thereafter, there was no effort, either through a proper motion to strike at the end of the evidence or at the close of his evidence, or in a motion to set aside the verdict, to give the trial court an opportunity to make a legal ruling as to this legal question. And therefore, it is not properly before this court. Because in essence, what he's asking this court to do is to make a factual determination that's not an appellate issue that the jury made. So once it went to the jury, it's not raisable, I would argue. I would say I'm not sure that this particular issue has come up as clearly, perhaps, as it ought to, but there is no reason why I would argue that this sort of issue should be treated any different than any other legal issue on a motion to strike. With regard to the probable cause issue, there was probable cause to believe that the defendant was drunk in public, and the trial court had mentioned these specific things, the smell of alcohol, which is on page 59 of the joint appendix, the 1,000-yard stare that the officer pointed to, his slurred speech, which is also on page 59 and 92 of the joint appendix, his lying by the side of the road. Let's not forget that there was testimony at trial, which, of course, this court can use to rely on in determining probable cause, that the EMT person told the police officers what she had observed and why she was calling them for assistance. And the reasons that she gave was that this person appeared to, quote, have an altered mental state and appeared to be under the influence of something, was not responsive, was laying on the side of the road, and she was concerned because it was unusual behavior at that time of day. So for all of those reasons, he was confused and groggy, she said, and that's on page, 212 of the joint appendix. And so for all of those reasons, even without the preliminary breath test, there was probable cause to believe that the defendant was drunk in public.
Ms. Boyd, do you understand, I think I did, that in essence, assignment of error one has been abandoned?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
That assignment of error one has been abandoned.
If the court would like me to address assignment of error one, I'm happy to do so. My understanding is that has been abandoned, and there are actually three reasons why it's without merit. One is it was a new crime that was committed, an assault and battery. Two, it had no relation to the statements that he made. And three, he was not in custody. For all of those reasons, I would argue that argument is without merit. But I believe that there's been a concession, so otherwise I would just rely on my brief for the specifics. I do think that this case offers the court a unique opportunity to address the issue of affirmative defenses and how they must be preserved, because I'm not sure that the case law has had the opportunity to clearly address this situation the way it has in this case. But unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you would affirm. Thank you very much.
Seeing no questions, thank you. Mr. Garrity.
Just to respond to a couple of points addressed by the Commonwealth, it is true that a motion to suppress has been filed. A motion to suppress, though, is not the proper vehicle to try to argue to a court that there's a right to resist an illegal arrest. That's a separate issue.
But did the trial court give you a ruling that there was probable cause for the arrest?
Yes, sir. Within the context of whether or not statements came in.
Right. If there was probable cause to arrest, and that finding is unchallenged, then don't our cases say that then we have to assume that the arrest was lawful?
No, I don't necessarily believe that that's the case. The Supreme, again, the trial court was looking at it through the motion to suppress only in the context of whether or not statements or other things came in. That ties more to our assignment of error number one. Whether or not the fact finder, and again, this is a question for the fact finder, in our opinion. I think the case law backs us up on that.
Well, and then implicit in them finding him guilty is that they're a finding that they thought that the arrest was lawful.
Well, I think that given that the instruction that was given, that's how they found. That's correct. And what we're saying is it's incorrect. The new crime argument is one more issue I want to bring up. That is not necessarily applicable in this present case. So even if an arrest is illegal, the case law does state, and then something takes place subsequent to that, that is a crime, just because the initial arrest was illegal doesn't necessarily mean that the person is alleviated of their new actions. However, the common law states, and this is what is this based on, if the arrest is illegal, there is a right to lawfully resist. So I don't think you can say that goes out the door just because it's a new crime.
Your time has expired. We'll come down and greet counsel. It is 11:05. We will reset.